The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I like to call this the Empowerment Hour, because I can promise you, no matter what your background, we will share insights, information that is relevant to broadening our perspectives, to live a longer and healthier life, to protect the planet, and to better organize our thoughts so we have some good actions that can go forward. Today, no guest. I wanted more opportunity to share some commentaries. I'll have one from Chris Hedges from TruthDig.com, A Movement Too Big to Fail. I'll challenge that. I believe that it can fail. I'll also be sharing some thoughts from Professor Heidi Hunter, Stony Brook University professor and associate professor of sustainability, and on resources on nuclear power. I want to share this with all of you who have yet to watch Knocking on the Devil's Door. This is a major issue. This really dwarfs any other issue in this moment, because if there should be a meltdown or an accident, a severe one, equal to Fukushima at Indian Point, you will see the largest number of people injured, poisoned, or killed in world history in a short period of time. So I think at some point we have to bring in some adults and refocus upon what's really important, and we're losing sight of that. Also today, our issue of the day, shy children are at risk of being diagnosed with mental disorders. Children who are merely shy or sad are at risk of being told that they have a brain chemical imbalance and forced to take a powerful drug. Why isn't this important? And yet 10 million children each day must take a prescription medication for their brain or they can't go to school. And yet that's not on anyone's talking points. And then, for those of you who've questioned that there's no real proof that 9/11 was not what we were told, time permitting, I will list some of the people that you could not have imagined have challenged the official 9/11 report. Some of the leading people within the military, the CIA, the FBI, and even the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Thomas Kane, former governor in New Jersey, himself. So it'll give you a little different perspective that there is legitimacy in deconstructing the official arguments. Let's begin. Always with empowering information on health, and always from good quality science. Now, ginger is an important nutrient to take into our system. If you've never grown ginger, it grows 10, 12 feet high, gives out a very nice aroma at night, has a nice white shoot on it. I grow ginger. I have a lot of ginger growing. But the ginger root is where the power is. That's where the powerful healing is. And it can be anywhere from 3 or 4 or 5 inches to as long as 6 or 7 inches. Generally about half to an inch thick. How I like to take it is I peel the ginger about 2 inches, dice it up very thinly sliced, and then put it in salads or saute it very lightly. And there's a reason why ginger should be in your diet. Not just because it helps eliminate motion sickness, but because it turns off inflammation. And it turns off inflammation first in your stomach. Now, you ask people, do you ever have upset stomach, gastric reflux? You'll be surprised at the enormous amount of people who do. And almost always these are the people drinking soft drinks or drinking coffee, because the caffeine in coffee is highly anabolic, very destructive, and changes the pH, making you more acidic. Ginger comes in and turns off inflammation. Then when ginger goes on through the stomach and into the top 12 inches of the intestine, the duodenum, and then into the rest of the intestine, it begins the process of turning off inflammation as well. This is the latest research. This is in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Prevention. It was done at the University of Michigan Medical School. Quote, regular consumption of ginger root or its supplements could reduce the risk of colon cancer by as much as 28%, and it turns off inflammation in the colon. And of course, you have to have inflammation prior to having colon cancer. So if you turn off the inflammation, then you're reducing your risk of developing the cancer. And this was done in a double-blind study, so very important. They isolated certain eicosanoids, which were the ingredient that turned it off. So ginger in any product is anti-inflammatory, and I recommend it. For pregnant women, first you were told don't exercise, then you were told exercise, then you were told exercise a little but not too much. Here's the latest in the American Physiological Society, based upon research done at the University of Minnesota Medical School. It shows that exercising before and during pregnancy increases two beneficial proteins for mothers-to-be, and that's all important. So you need exercise, and you need power walking, biking, and light jogging. And it helps with the vascular endothelial growth factor. That's a protein, and that's very important. So exercise, yes. Exercise vigorously, yes. And power walking and biking are your two best exercises. Now, one other thing that is beneficial if you breastfeed, this is according to Science Daily, you're going to reduce the risk of allergies to your child. And just think of how many people today have allergens. Now, what we think is wrong. We think that we develop an allergy to house dust mites, pets, pollens, and that's how we end up with allergens. Not the way it works. What happens is that because of what your mother ate and drank or didn't, and then that immediately goes through your body and from her body into yours. But then if your mother breastfeeds you, then that helps build up your immune system and therefore makes you less genetically susceptible to, you got it, dust, house dust mites, pets and pollens, and food allergens. So if you want to be having children that are less allergic, breastfeed. How to punish corporate wrongdoers to deter bad behavior? This is from Science Daily, and it says, if courts were able to award appropriate punitive damages that punish wrongdoers at a level tied to a company's financial worth, then businesses big and small would be at risk of being put out of business by punitive damages, unconscionable offenses, and would be deterred from bad behavior in the first place. That's according to Judge Zimmet of the Phoenix School of Law. And he was writing in the International Journal of Private Law, points out that in many legal cases over the last two decades, companies have repeatedly been fined for breaking environmental and other laws, but have not suffered losses to their profit line that were adequate to deter them from repeating offenses. Okay, here's my thoughts on this, because it's something I just finished with. I was curious. On one hand, we are told, invite people on radio and television, get them to do articles, get them to speak before groups like the Free Enterprise Institute, the Hoover Institute, who support the free market. Also, these are people that, if they're very successful and have been at the head of a major corporation, are generally considered very ethical, or they wouldn't have been appointed. All right, so I did two things. I took all the pharmaceutical companies in the United States for the past 30 years, and I simply added up the number of dollars they spent in damages from being found guilty or settling lawsuits, how many people were injured, and how many died. I then added up all the lawsuits from all the Wall Street banks, like Goldman Sachs, and how much money they spent, and what were their crimes. Was it insider trading, price fixing? And the numbers are staggering. Now, if we want to talk about morality and ethics, no one from the pharmaceutical industry or Wall Street would make even the worst list. These people are beyond bad. The amounts are approaching $1 trillion. You heard me right. Not billions, nearly $1 trillion in damages. And here is the problem. Many are repeat offenders. And why not? Built in, for example, to the cost of doing a drug is the cost of people getting sick and dying. So they've already factored in there, if they sell $5 billion worth of their drug and 100 people die and they're fined $500 million, $500 million is already into their profit picture. So it's just the cost of doing business. It's a certain percentage of doing business. Might be 2%, might be 5%. In an extreme case, like with Vioxx, where the settlement was $5.85 billion, 60,000 people died. That's more than all of American casualties in the 10 wars, the Vietnam War. The price of their stock went up because Wall Street loves someone who can pay a fine and then get back to business, even if getting back to business is making more deadly drugs. And the vaccine makers are particularly adept at this. They make sure through their lobbyists and through ALEC and through the K Street firms that they are never held accountable financially for any death or damage from any vaccine. Why not? If you produce, say, antipsychotic medication or a tranquilizer or a calcium blocker, if you produce an chemotherapy drug, and if that damages anyone, you have to pay a fine. Why not with vaccines? Could it be because they know that the vaccines are toxic? Could they know that they're not effective? Could they know that as long as they continue this public scam, they can't go back? You can't go to saying you need 10, 20, 30, 40, 60 vaccines in your schedule between birth and 6 years of age and then say, oh, we got it wrong, you don't need any. Then people are going to say, what do you mean you got it wrong? You mean you've been vaccinating Americans at ever-increasing dosages? What part was wrong? That they didn't work was wrong, or they weren't safe was wrong, or both? Well, they're both. Vaccines cannot be proven safe or effective, and therefore we were wrong. Well, then how long before the massive class action litigation occurs? How long before the people that got the vaccine company money, the legislators, start being put on the spot? So rather than to acknowledge that the entire vaccine industry is a scam, they simply managed to get themselves indemnified and continue on making profits. After all, the government will frequently pay manufacturers to develop a vaccine, then pay them when they give you the vaccine. It's a win-win. They don't have to put their own money into it to develop it. The government gives them the patent. And then if they hurt people, the government says you can't sue them. So that's the current status. Now, this is really bad. This evening at 7 p.m., on the Progressive Commentary Hour that I do each week at this time, 1 hour or more, I will have Dr. Andrew Wakefield present his defense against the British Medical Society, against The Lancet, against CNN and Anderson Cooper and all the other people that attacked him, saying that he falsely claimed that the MMR vaccine used on a group of children in England led to autism. And hence, they took away his medical license and they pillared him. You will see from this discussion this evening, which will be extremely methodical, that none of that is true. And you also see the truth about the vaccine, the danger of the vaccine that he and others discovered. And rather than the British government acknowledging that they had a bad vaccine that was injuring kids, they covered it up. And no one figured they would ever uncover it. He uncovered it. And because he uncovered it, he paid a price. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, for about 28 minutes this evening, showing that every challenge against him was wrong, and anyone who had done real homework would have shown that. and it's a major scandal. In any case, later this week, I will do a special one-hour presentation, an original in-depth investigative report on the lack of safety in vaccines. Just one topic, safety. This is a continuation of a series on vaccines, and I will show you why, when they say a vaccine is safe, they have no proof of that, but we have a lot of proof that they're not. All of my information will be fully referenced. All of it will be able to withstand cross-examination in a court of law. So those of you who feel that you could use this as a way of boosting your own legal challenges can do so. Now, on to the next issue. Feed your memory with vitamin C-rich fruit. This is something that we need more of. It talks about Alzheimer's disease, how prevalent it is, how it's just gone crazy all over the world. But there are certain fruits and vegetables that are packed with fiber and vitamin C, hundreds of antioxidants, including lutein and lycopene, and that this dietary approach can help lower the risk of heart attack, stroke, high blood pressure, macular degeneration, and even cancers. And now they're saying it can help your memory. But many of you already know that. But this is news to the people in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that just did this, published this article. So they're finding the very things many of you are taking every day, everyone should be taking. Vitamin C, rich produce, and lots of colorful vegetables and fruits. They're suggesting 7 to 10 servings a day, and I'm suggesting 11 servings a day. So it's nice to know that they're catching up. And now they're associating getting rid of that and preventing that toxic amyloid beta plaque in the brain, the sticky protein linked to Alzheimer's. And they're saying, oh, well, take your vitamin E and sunflower seeds and grapeseed extract and almonds and hazelnuts and greens, vegetables and papaya and berries. And you've been doing that all along. So that's good news. And one other thing here, in order to limit your night vision loss, bilberries, bilberries, for centuries, bilberries have been used for health reasons. And among the best reasons, it improves capillary health, which then improves circulation to the eyes, and that improves vision. And it's the flavonoids found in bilberries, known as anthocyanicides, which are responsible for regeneration of what is called rhodopsin. And this is the purple pigment in the eye, which is responsible for night vision. So what you have is you have a berry that can also help with diabetic retinopathy, macular degeneration, and cataracts. And it helps protect the collagen structures in the blood vessels in the eye. And there was a study that showed this. And that's why during World War II, pilots, especially flying at night, were always giving bilberry supplements or bilberry jam to take. Because remember, bilberries or supplements of bilberry improve circulation. By the way, for the women, they ease menstrual cramps and reduce the appearance of varicose veins. And those suffering from thrombosis and angina can benefit significantly by using bilberry supplements. And it slows down the aging process. It helps trap free radicals. It's just terrific. And it helps lower your blood sugar to a normal level. So start to include some bilberries into your diet. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Sitting in a tiny table in a ritzy restaurant, she was staring at her coffee cup. He was trying to keep his courage up by applying booze. Talk was small when they talked at all. They both knew what they wanted.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. For those of you who, like myself, are concerned that we become a nation over-medicated, over-diagnosed, and over-treated, this is something from Martin Beckford that is of interest. And it says the following. Psychologists say that new guidelines being developed in America will lead more young people seeing their common problems regarded as illnesses that must be treated rather than just be given support. They fear that pupils who are quiet at school could be diagnosed with social anxiety disorder, while those who become withdrawn after suffering a bereavement are classified as having a depressive disorder. Children who just talk back to adults or lose their temper regularly can be diagnosed with oppositional defiance disorder. As a result, those found to have these increasingly broad, supposedly mental disorders could be prescribed powerful medication like Prozac and Ritalin to control or alter their behavior. Now the pressure is increasing for a national review of the use of such drugs on school children, as well as more research into their long-term effects. Unfortunately, no such effort in the United States. The new DSM-5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, a book that diagnoses normal behavior as disease, is going to be coming out shortly, and watch the number of young people, children, adolescents, and teenagers now diagnosed with psychiatric disorders and forced to be put on medications. And any parent that objects, that parent could be reported to social services, even arrested, your child taken away. Think that's an exaggeration? It is not. It's already happening. Why? Because the pharmaceutical industry, with its allied group, have managed to meet with the federal authorities and legislators and state legislators, convincing them, as they always have, and 800 other pieces of legislation, that it's in their best interest to get reelected. So your legislators have sold you out at the federal and the state level, and the cost of this sellout is the future health of your child. Your thoughts, the over-medicating, the over-drugging, and virtually no one in Congress stopping it. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Anyone who has visited New Orleans, which I have done many, many, many times, in fact, just very recently, and now I have to go back next week. I have to be on in Monday in Mississippi, Tuesday, Louisiana, Wednesday, Alabama, Thursday, the south coast of Texas, filming the people who've developed environmental illnesses from the Gulf spill and have lost their homes or work because of it. I always stop in New Orleans because it's on the way. And I go out to the wards and where a lot of people have been affected. And people are always wondering, how is it that FEMA didn't do more? Now, there was an analysis by G. Edward Griffin, and I got the actual citations. These are official citations. I never heard of these. Did you? Because a lot of people think, well, FEMA didn't offer enough help because it was just, it was not interested because this wasn't a wealthy neighborhood. I don't believe that. Quote, FEMA tells first responders not to respond until they're told to. That's some FEMA's own news, 2005, August 28th. FEMA won't accept Amtrak's help in evacuations. FEMA News. Offer of helicopters for rescue work is rejected by Narcosphere. FEMA blocks 500 Florida airboat pilots from rescue work. The Sun Sentinel. FEMA to Chicago. Just send one truck. The Chicago Tribune, September 2nd, 2005. FEMA turns back volunteer sheriff deputies and medical team. FEMA bars morticians from entering New Orleans. Pentagon says military mission in New Orleans is combat, not rescue. FEMA blocks 500-boat citizen flotilla from delivering aid. Homeland Security won't let Red Cross deliver food. Each one is a different headline. FEMA, a military turns back flood survivors trying to leave city. Thousands held at gunpoint and locked up in Superdome. FEMA fails to utilize Navy ship with 600-bed hospital on board. FEMA cuts local emergency communication phone lines. FEMA turns away experienced firefighters. FEMA turns back Walmart supply trucks. FEMA prevents Coast Guard from delivering diesel fuel. Navy pilots who rescued victims are reprimanded. U.S. government turns back German plane with 15 tons of AIDS. FEMA officials forbid stores from reopening. Sheriff defies their order and threatens to arrest them. FEMA declines volunteer firemen for rescue operations. Use them to distribute public relations pamphlets. FEMA orders doctor to stop treating hurricane victims. FEMA ignores offer of buses for evacuation of New Orleans. So what's going on here? Were agents of the federal government so foolish? What were they doing? Just to let you know, this is the same FEMA that everybody thinks is so necessary and gets massive funding and has enormous power over your lives. Now, some good news for those of you who want to know about the truth about this radiation. And there are many good organizations, the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, Clearwater, Government Accountability Project, Greenpeace USA, Endpoint, Safe Energy Coalition, Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Institute for Policy Studies, Nuclear Information Research Services, Nuke Free, Project on Government Oversight, Public Citizen. Here's some facts that I'm sure you don't know and why you should make this important so it gets up high on your priority list. First, let's just take a look at the electricity problem, because here's their argument. Nuclear power is safe, it's green, it's non-polluting, no greenhouse gases, and if you should turn off one of these electrical or nuclear power plants, you could wait 20 years before there's another source of energy to take its place. Fact. The Endpoint reactors produce about 2,000 megawatts of electricity. The New York City Westchester grid uses 9 to 13,000 megawatts daily, depending upon the temperature. If the Southeastern United States grid took all of that output, elementary school division would reveal that Endpoint could provide a maximum of about 15 to 22% of the region's electrical power. Check the Con Ed website and you'll see that 30% of the electricity that they purchase comes from nuclear power. However, this includes all of the reactors in New York and the two in New Jersey, not just Endpoint. Since Endpoint supplies a relatively small portion of electricity to the grid, between 15 and 22%, depending upon weather and usage, replacement is not a difficult task. The current recession has curtailed the expanding need for electricity. Nevertheless, providing electricity remains a very big business with many different providers paying for the contracts. If one source of production comes off the market, other vendors are available to profit from the opportunity. That is the way the free market works. Long-term contracts are the cheapest way for industrial users to purchase electricity. Eliminating confusion over when Endpoint would come offline would allow all concerned to respond to bids for replacement energy. We have a robust grid and a free market that supplies it. The lights stay on when the plant closes for refueling or for an outage. So there is no reason to think that adequate business sense and planning ahead would not produce the same result once the plant was taken offline permanently. In fact, Governor Cuomo is fast-tracking a Hudson River transmission line from New Jersey into New York City that will carry 600 megawatts. In addition, 1,000 megawatt direct current, which is DC transmission line, coming down from Canada, is in the early stages of siting. And we should not forget that vigorous efficiency and conservation measures have saved up to 15% of the statewide usage in both Vermont and California. There's no reason to think that such a measure could not also be effective in New York. Here's what you don't know. Endpoint is the single largest user of water in the state. The twin 40-foot-wide intake conduits to the two power plants take in 2.5 billion That's with a B, billion gallons of Hudson water every 24 hours. At 10 feet a story, that makes the pipe as wide as a four-story building is tall. Every year, the once-through cooling system at Endpoint uses the equivalent of twice the volume of the river from the Battery to Troy, New York, a distance of 183 miles. This is documented in the environmental impact study published by the New York Department of Environmental Conservation. Other power plants use a lot of water also, but not as much as Endpoint. Despite Entergy's claims, it is tremendous waste of water. But also there's something else that happens that we're not told. Every year, 1.5 billion, again with a B, billion fish are sucked into the plant's intake system. fact, this figure does not include the fish eggs, larvae, and plankton, which are also drawn in through the 40-foot-wide intake pipe. Energy's propaganda to the contrary, the death of 2 billion fish every year, is not well within the bounds of the ecosystem's ability to replace it, as they have said. This argument has lost at every judicial proceeding to date. There is no comparison between 1.5 billion fish that fail to reach maturity because they are eaten or other fish by other fish or nourish the food chain, and the 1.5 billion fish vacuumed out of the food chain by the intake pipes, killed, and then dumped back into the Hudson River ecosystem as decaying organic matter. Removing such from the bottom of the food chain has an adverse impact on the entire ecosystem. Now, as part of the environmental impact assessment, the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation counted the number of 5 species of fish, 2 surface dwellers, 1 middle-level swimmer, and 2 bottom-dwelling fish over the course of a year, and found that an additional 500 million fish died when they encountered thermal plume from the hot water dumped back into the river as part of a once-through cooling. The water in the thermal plant that comes out is 40 degrees hotter than the river water. Well, you would know in your own home, if you had a goldfish and you suddenly put some hot water in there, it's going to kill it. Well, now you're at 500 million more dead fish. And there's no difference between a closed cooling system and cooling towers. And as the name implies, a closed cycle cooling reduces the need for water by reusing the same water over and over again. And that would reduce the water usage by 95%. That also eliminates 95% of the fish that are killed. But they're not doing it because the manufacturer doesn't want to spend the money to create that. And then every cost analysis and benefit analysis shows that it is not cost effective. So we have to stop this. And also stop the lies. Nuclear is not carbon emission free. The mining, the milling, the enrichment, the transport, the heavy construction needed, and the associated fossil fuel-based support services all create carbon emissions. The uranium enrichment plant down in Kentucky is attached to a coal-burning generator. The only part of the fuel life cycle that does not generate a carbon emission is the chain reaction that creates heat to boil water. Also, nuclear is not a renewable energy resource. Like other mineral fuel sources, uranium is a finite material. Some believe we have already reached peak yield of uranium mining, and the reprocessing of old nuclear materials is now being done to increase output yield. And then also, nuclear plants are already contaminating the environment. At Indian Point 1, the spent fuel pool leached strontium-90 into the groundwater, and carcinogenic tritium has leaked into pool at Indian Point 2. Tritium also has leaked from the number of other plants around the country, and outside the Braidwood plant in Illinois, tritium water was found in homeowners' sinks. They turn on the tap and out came radioactive water. Even when radioactive leaks do not go into a known drinking source, does not mean that radioactive leaks are safe. More than 25% of U.S. nuclear plants have had radioactive water leakages. Indian Point's sister plant, Vermont Yankee, has leaked radioactive tritium, cesium-137, cobalt-60, manganese-54, and zinc-65 into groundwater under the plant. And at Oyster Creek, the water is reaching the aquifer that supplies drinking water to most of southern Jersey. Did you know that, southern Jersey? The National Academy of Sciences has stated unequivocally that no level of exposure to ionizing radiation can be considered safe. Even low-level exposure increases the likelihood of cancers and birth defects. And nuclear is not economical if you include the government subsidies. And remember, we pay for all of their overruns. We pay to help build their plants. We pay to try to decommission a plant, which is $1.5 billion. They just take the profits. So if you let them pay for all their own expenses, anyone opening a business would do, you wouldn't have a single plant open. And that's why I'm hoping that you will call Governor Cuomo's office and politely and positively say, we do not want Indian Point open. Call from New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New York, because if there's a meltdown at Indian Point, you're all going to be contaminated. and they have absolutely zero plans for evacuation, and they have no way of getting rid of the spent fuel material. No place to put it, no place to decontaminate it. So that's just the facts on it. We're going to take your calls in a moment, and but I want to share two different perspectives on this. And that's why I didn't have a guest. I want to have a little time to do this. First up, I just returned late last night from Washington, D.C., where I was filming all day yesterday. And I want to thank so many people from New York City who joined me there. I was just amazed at how many people walked from Brooklyn, the 316 miles, to be down there. It was a wonderful rally. I was filming all day, and not just at the anti-genetic engineering, but the anti-poverty and the Occupy Wall Street. I was covering all these. There are different ways of seeing what's occurring. I'd like to share my perspective. But I also want to share Chris Hedges. He believes the following, and these are his words. As always, he is extraordinarily articulate. There is no danger that the protesters who have occupied squares, parks, and plazas across the nation in defiance of the corporate state will be co-opted by the Democratic Party or groups like Move On. The faux liberal reformers, whose abject failure to stand up for the rights of the poor and the working class, have signed on to this movement because they fear becoming irrelevant. Union leaders who pull down salaries five times that of the rank and file as they bargain away rights and benefits know the foundations are shaking. So do Democratic politicians from Barack Obama to Nancy Pelosi. So do the array of liberal groups and institutions, including the press, that have worked to funnel discontented voters back into the swamp of electoral politics and mock those who call for profound structural reform. Tinkering with the corporate state will not work. We will either be plunged into neo-feudalism and environmental catastrophe, or we will wrest power from corporate hands. This radical message, one that demands a reversal of the corporate coup, is one the power elite, including the liberal class, is desperately trying to thwart. But the liberal class has no credibility left. It collaborated with corporate lobbyists to neglect the rights of tens of millions of Americans, as well as the innocents in our imperial wars. The best that liberals can do is to sheepishly pretend that this is what they wanted all along. Groups such as MoveOn.org and Organized Labor will find themselves without a constituency unless they at least pay lip service to the protest. The Teamsters' arrival Friday morning to help defend the park signaled an infusion of this new radicalism into the moribund unions rather than a co-opting of the protest movement by the traditional liberal establishment. The union bosses, in short, had no choice. The Occupy Wall Street movement, like all radical movements, has obliterated the narrow political parameters. It proposes something new. It will not make concessions with corrupt systems of corporate power. It holds fast to moral imperatives, regardless of the cost. It confronts authority out of a sense of responsibility. It is not interested in formal positions of power. It is not seeking office. It is not trying to get people to vote. It has no resources. It can't carry suitcases of money to congressional offices or run millions of dollars of advertisement. All it can do is ask us to use our bodies and voices, often at personal risk, to fight back. It has no other way to defy the corporate state. This rebellion creates a real community instead of a managed one or virtual one. It affirms our dignity. It permits us to become free and independent human beings. Martin Luther King was repeatedly betrayed by liberal supporters, especially when he began to challenge the economic forms of discrimination, which demanded that liberals, rather than simply white Southern racists, begin to make sacrifices. King, too, was a radical. He would not compromise on nonviolence, racism, or justice. He understood that movements, such as the Liberty Party, which fought slavery, the suffragettes, who fought for women's rights, the labor movement, and the civil rights movement, have always been the true correctives in American democracy. None of those movements achieved formal political power, but by holding fast to moral imperatives, they made the powerful fear them. King knew that racial equality was impossible without economic justice and an end to militarism. And he had no intention of ceding to the demands of the liberal establishment that called on him to be calm and patient. quote, "For years, I labor with the idea of reforming the existing institutions in the South. A little change here, a little change there," King said shortly before he was assassinated. Quote, "Now I feel differently. I think you've got to have a constructive, a reconstruction of the entire system, a revolution of values," unquote. King was killed in 1968 when he was in Memphis to support a strike by sanitation workers. By then he had begun to say that his dream, the one that the corporate state had frozen into a safe cliché from his 1963 speech in Washington, had turned into a nightmare. King called at the end of his life for massive federal funds to rebuild inner cities, what he called a radical redistribution of economic and political power, a complete restructuring of the architecture of American society. He grasped that the inequalities of capitalism had become the instrument by which the poor would always remain poor. "Call it democracy, call it democratic socialism," King said, "but there must be a better distribution of wealth within this country for all of God's children." On the eve of King's murder, he was preparing to organize a Poor People's March on Washington, designed to cause major massive dislocations, a nonviolent demand by the poor, including the white underclass, for a system of economic equality. It would be 43 years before his vision was realized by an eclectic group of protesters who gathered before the gates of Wall Street. The truth of America is understood only when you listen to voices in our impoverished rural enclaves, prisons, and the urban slums. When you hear the words of our unemployed, those who have lost their homes or cannot pay their medical bills, our elderly and our children, especially the quarter of the nation's children who depend upon food stamps to eat, and all who are marginalized, there is more reality expressed about the American experience by the debt-burdened young and men and women protesting in the parks than by all the chatter of the well-paid pundits and the experts that pollute the airwaves. And those are Chris Hedges' feelings on this in an editorial. Back in a moment with my thoughts, and you can share yours. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. And this evening on the Progressive Commentary Hour at 7 p.m., I will be at that time sharing with you at least 50 quotes verbatim from some of the most important people that you've never heard, who all believe that the official version of the 9/11 events is a fraud, and that we need in its place an authentic, independent panel of experts to give testimony under oath with no exceptions. So that's coming at you tonight, and Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and a big problem out there, you're not hearing about it, I've told you about it before, it just got bigger. Derivatives. The $600 trillion time bomb that's set to explode. You don't know what a derivative is? You will tonight. Five banks in the United States hold 95% of the derivatives. And that's according to the Office of Currency Controller. J.P. Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, Bank America, and Goldman Sachs. Derivatives played a crucial role in bringing down the global economy, so you would think that the world's top policymakers would have reined in these things, that Obama, by executive order, would have stopped them. You wouldn't be close to being accurate on that. I'll talk about the derivatives. The big implosion is going to be happening and what it's going to do to the world economy. That'll be exclusively on my program tonight, on the Progressive Commentary Hour, 7 p.m., only on the Progressive Radio Network. And I want to thank the nearly 200,000 different individuals who downloaded last week's commentary, making it something people are listening to. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us all this week and next week. Songs from the 70s. Now let's go over and say hello to Alan from Brooklyn. Alan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Thank you very much for taking my call. If you don't mind, it's twofold. Is there a way for these young girls that have been vaccinated with Gardasil to chelate it out of their systems. And number two, with the solar storms, when you first started talking about them, you mentioned that there was an Israeli scientist that said he discovered a spray that he could spray on the wires to give it some kind of surge protection.
Alan, that's not me. I made no such statement. Don't know any such person. To your first yes, there are ways of helping young women, 110 of whom have died. 5,000 have ended up with permanent disabilities. 25,000 have reported adverse effects from Gardasil. It is a fraudulent vaccine. There is nothing legitimate about it. I have an article up on my website. Go to Progressive Radio Network and you'll see everything that the media will not tell you, nor Dr. Gupta or anyone else, about the truth about Gardasil. It's a complete fraud at every level. And that's why I'm doing this whole series on vaccines. And I did a report. The report is a complete report, completely scientific reference on what you need to know about the solar flares that are coming. There is no question they are coming. There is also no question that this will be a massive one, possibly as bad as the Carrington effect in the 1800s. And there's no question that we should be concerned. The issue is, how much damage will it do? I interviewed, and it's in the report that's up online, that the utility companies say they don't believe it's going to be that bad, and they believe that they have the capacity to fix any problem quickly. Let's hope they're right. But right now, there are no surge protectors. I would say that rather than having it melt down a transformer, which cannot be replaced because we don't manufacture these transformers in the United States, they're manufactured in India and China with a three-year waiting list, that we should insist that we start getting our government to mandate that every nuclear facility have surge protectors and every one of the 450 major power grids and substations have surge protectors. That is prevention. That's good news. That's something we have time to do, and that's relatively inexpensive. The House of Representatives agrees with that and has voted unanimously for that. The Senate has stopped it, and the utilities don't want to do it. And they control the spin. They control the media. That's why I put this article up there. So I'm still optimistic that there is time that we could prevent this from even being tested. But listen here, Alan, how do you get that someone in a utility can guarantee you that it's not going to be a problem when they've never in this lifetime had a cataclysmic solar storm? If you've never had a storm, that's like saying, listen, I can get shot in the head and I can withstand it. It won't hurt me. How do you know? You ever had a bullet in your brain? How would you know? How would you know if you've never had a gigantic storm of this magnitude? How would you know your capacity to defend it? There's no mathematical model that I can find out there, and I'm looking. So they're wrong. I believe that we should move aggressively, and in that light, I'll be presenting a program next week with an article on how to prevent the catastrophe from a solar storm, what we can do now, okay? Let's say hello to Austin from Jersey City. Hi, Austin.
How are you, Gary?
Good. You're on.
Yeah, Gary, I just want to say I was watching CBS Sunday Morning yesterday, and they were talking about pharmaceuticals. And Charles Osgood started us out with the intro. You know, we all know that pharmaceuticals keep us healthy and give us a better life. Something just clicked in my head when he said that. And it's this: the fixate. You know, they were talking about the overuse and the piece that they did, the you know, problems with abuse of drugs. That fixating on overuse is a perfect smokescreen for the bigger issue of the efficacy of pharmaceuticals to begin with. If we engage this dialogue, which I think the pharmaceutical companies really like, of just worrying about the overuse, we never get to the logical presupposition that would go before that. That are these things affected to begin with? Because we're already putting a rubber stamp on them if what we are talking about is the misuse of them. The implication is that they're helpful to begin with if used properly.
All right. Well, I've addressed four issues, including the one you ask. I ask, are medications and medical practices safe? Are they effective? And if so, what proof? Then I ask the same question in reverse. Are pharmaceuticals not effective? And are they not safe, and what is the proof? And therefore, I've laid out all that and answered it all in Death by Medicine. and which is a took 7 years to do. It's a very scholarly paper, and that answers that. They are not effective, and they are not safe. That's why they're the number one cause of death, and they're only effective in 10 to 12% of cases, which means 88, 90% of all medical procedures are not proven effective by their own standards and are not safe. And that's why you have anywhere from 600,000 to 900,000 people dying each year because of these medical errors. I'm Gary Noll in Studios Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Gary. I have an email here from John Hand. He sent some great questions, by the way. He says, "Hi, Gary. I'm in my third year of college, and by the time I graduate, I will have over $100,000 in student debt. I'm seriously considering your recommendation of intentionally defaulting on my loans and organizing my peers to do the same, but I'm concerned about the impact this will have on my father, who is a co-signer on my loans. The government and banks are very clever to force parents to co-sign on these loans. I'm sure many other students are afraid to refuse to pay back their loans because of this effective deterrent. What is your view on this?" Cheers, John Hand.
You certainly should not do anything without consulting your father. But I believe after... Let me just give you one example. I've been down to Wall Street about 20 times. I've taken food. I've shared insights. I've filmed a lot of people trying to get perspective. For movements to sustain themselves, they have to be viable at many levels, even if it initially there are it becomes an amalgamation of many different ideas, which is fine. But then which ideas will carry the day? Well, saying that you're against greed, we're all against greed, and you're against the imbalance in power, any reasonable person's against that, either from a group on Wall Street or from a government bureaucracy, which I'm opposed to. The nature of what bureaucracies do when you don't keep them in check and they have runaway power. But also, at some point, you hopefully will evolve individually or collectively a consciousness to say, let us direct our energies towards something that we can actually see change. Or we can shake the basis of power and those who have power. Meetings, you could have 100,000 rallies. If there's not a threat by the people that you're actually going to do something that will change their power structure, it will just be a bubble. And I believe that right now what we're seeing is a bubble of excessive exuberance and enthusiasm, and we're giving virtue and value to many of the people in this movement who have yet to earn it. The mere fact that a young person or anyone shows up for something doesn't in itself legitimize either the person or the movement. It merely means someone showed up. All right? Why did you show up? What are you willing to do? A good example. Yesterday, I asked many of the people who were rallying to stop the labeling of food, would they be willing to come over and give some moral support and to the people who were taking over a park and sleeping in tents? They said, absolutely, yes. And I said, after the last speaker, let's all go over there and show solidarity. In the interim, I was over there at that little, you know, the little tent city talking with people, and this was rather represented. In fact, it was exclusively the opinion, or it was not an exception, it was the idea. These two people sleeping in the tent, very articulate, very intelligent, school teachers, who were there to show that for the 9 days they've been there, what it's like to be, you know, a poor person. They were not. They have a privileged background. But they were giving truth the idea that we're not willing to put ourselves in someone else's shoes. And, well, they were making a sacrifice. But then I said, I'm all over the country speaking with poor people, and a lot of them don't have the benefit of what you have. You have a pup tent, you have clothes, you have food that comes 3 or 4 times a day. They don't. I can show you people who don't know the next meal, eating out of dumpsters, and sleep wherever they can. Why don't you invite some of the homeless people in to share that, or go out where they're at and share their experience, not in this environment where you're 100% supported? Because there's something else that we're not taking into account. What about the lack of support for all the senior citizens? There are millions who are suffering. And how about the 65 million Americans who are at the poverty level, the 50 million on food stamps? The others would get food stamps, but they have two jobs and they're making, you know, minimal wage at each one, so they don't qualify. What about all those people? We're not hearing their frustration and their anger. Anger at losing a home. And unless you direct something specifically to stop that, it won't stop. Bing, it was like Werner Erhard, who I challenged on my radio program. He had raised about $60 million in 1 year through his awareness of the poverty project. And I said, fine, but how many mouths have you fed? Well, none. Why? Well, it's not about really feeding mouths. It's about becoming more aware of something. This is nonsense. At the end of the day, it's about what can you do in your awareness to actually feed people and stop starvation and stop the wrong distribution and, of resources and foods. When I ask these people, one block away, there are people who are fighting to protect your right and your children's right, and there were two children there, not to eat genetically engineered food, not to have an eel crossbred with a salmon, but not tell you that it's an eel crossbred with a salmon and some other bacteria thrown in. You think you're eating salmon. You're not. They're there protesting. There's documentary, there's articles, there's organizations, they're here, they march from New York. Would you come over there just to lend them a little support, even to stand there and hear their talks? No. And no matter who I spoke to, the answer was no. And this brings into something that Chris Hedges obviously has not seen, but I have. At a certain level, you have to break everything into its pieces to analyze it properly. And if one piece is this kind of unbridled narcissism, we're here, so reality starts. Now we can really get serious in America. And before you showed up 30 days ago, we had no civil rights movement, we had no feminist movement, we had no protecting movement, there was no Ralph Nader. Was there anyone in the world before you showed up? This conceit, this lack of awareness of movements and how things actually get accomplished, of how to be organized in a way that serves a larger good, of how not to be co-opted by people who want your movement and want you so they can give you over to their movement. Everywhere I went, oh, Obama's going to stop Wall Street, and I kept saying Obama is Wall Street.
Right.
And yet you see where already they're being co-opted. And the whole idea that they're having all these assemblies to talk about the issues and how do you define the issues. And when I asked, I said, are any of these issues important to you? Closing down nuclear power plants, not on the agenda, right? How about withdrawing all of our military facilities? Well, those are on pause, yes, but otherwise. And I'm thinking, why not at least look at what many people have done, are doing? There's 5,533 different environmental groups alone. There's multiple anti-war groups. There's anti-corruption groups. And see what you can learn from people who've already been there and done that. This idea that because some people are showing up in not massive amounts by any means, but showing up in different places, that's good. That I support. That they're against corruption, good. That they're against some of the excesses, many of the excesses that we see in lack of distribution of resources, excellent. But that somehow they don't see that already there are people who've sacrificed. I can name you 1,000 men and women who spent their lives helping to stop the traffic in sex slaves, helping to stop in the prison abuses in the for-private prison system. I mean, real issues every day. As if none of this matters because we're going to make up our own agenda and we all want our own agenda, we all want our ideas, but somehow we'll manage to coalesce. What I'm saying now, unless I see this change and there be a lot more, allow a few adults into the discussion, you're going to see this grow and grow and grow from 10 to hundreds, from hundreds to thousands of groups around the world. And then, like all bubbles, this activist bubble will deflate and become irrelevant. I hope that it doesn't happen because I hope they understand that cooperation with other individuals and other groups on specific issues that can improve the quality of our lives is what's essential. Now, what could be done immediately? Immediately, you could say no more paying any of these college tuitions and no more college loans. Go on general strike against the universities, especially the universities have been increasing the tuition just to make it more profitable to the schools, and then say no to the government. If all the students said no, then they would be forced to cancel the student loans or renegotiate them without the interest and all the, and to allow a person to withdraw through bankruptcy if they can't pay it, which now they can't. But they have to use that. Now, that would help all students and their parents, and that would make a major dent. They could immediately stop. How do you hurt the people that you're against? You withdraw your financial support. Tear up your credit cards and debit cards. Don't shop anymore. Walmarts, Kmarts, Duane Reade's, Whole Foods. Stop all of the purchasing power of which you have over $120 billion a year. Withdraw that money from them and you affect them. All right? Don't vote for their politicians. Stop voting left and right. Because you do not have traditional liberal Democrats, and you do not have traditional conservative Republicans who represent more of the libertarian view. You have new Democrat, new liberals, and they're both corporatist. And they're going to eat you alive. Once you get in, you're already a part of it. You see, how do you extract part of you that is purchasing their iPods made in China, purchasing their clothes made in Bangladesh, eating their hamburgers where you didn't need to kill the cow and the cow was raised on genetically engineered beans that you felled a grain force in South America to eat? Any one of these is an important issue to educate yourself on. But if you're going to eat your hamburgers, drink your colas, wear your designer jeans and your designer glasses and your shoes, and if you're going to say, okay, I did my thing, now I can go back. If you separated out all the people who are really suffering from those who are there, and good for them, the idealists, let's say, those who chose to make a sacrifice, to identify, if you separated all those, you're going to be with an awful lot of people who go right back into the lifestyle that they had, one of consummate consumption, one that live on the internet, that live on games, that aren't a part in a constructive way and have been up to this point of stopping what allowed all this to accumulate. If you're part of the bubble that accumulated, if you participated in wanting to go to the best schools and without thinking, what does it mean to be a best school? Why do I have to pay this amount of money? Where does this money go? Then you're not changing anything. And I therefore challenge that Chris Hedges on this particular point should maybe reflect, because I've been all over this country. I am all over this country. I mean, in the last 5 days, I've been to 5 events. And when we asked the people from Wall Street, gave out thousands and thousands and thousands of literature and explained to them the dangers of nuclear radiation, oh, yeah, okay, not one showed up there to the demonstration. But everyone's willing to support them. At a certain point, this is just a reflection of this whole idea of we're entitled to our demonstrations, and ours are the demonstrations that matter, as if that's the only thing that's important. Right. It is important. It's not the only thing. And if you really don't want to be looked upon in the future as just, you know, a hypocrite, then get off the grid. Disconnect from that very body politic and corruption of Wall Street and the globalized power around you. If you really want to do something, then go on strike against your universities, because they're corrupt. And the whole system is corrupt. The educational system is corrupt. There you can have an impact. Because if enough people did that, then you would find yourself making some major changes, social changes. You look at any movement and you ask yourself, did any of these movements happen just because a lot of people got together and had some ideas? No. It takes a lot of planning. It takes direction. It takes understanding. It takes nuance. It takes looking at what you're trying to change and seeing the strength and weakness of the blowback from that, and also motivating individuals. We didn't get out of Vietnam because 600,000 of us marched in Washington. We'd like to think that. If we did, shame on us, because that's pure, unmitigated conceit. We got out of Vietnam for one reason only. When the average American started seeing their sons and daughters coming home injured, disfigured, or dead. And then they, in their churches, synagogues, and mosques, they said, no more. Who don't you see out there in these movements? You don't see the working poor. That's where your revolution is going to come from, not these people.
Right.
All right? Getting some pepper spray in your face, a few people, getting arrested and then let right back out, that's a whole lot different then the people are out there who are armed and angry and rageful, and they're the tinderbox in the United States. That's what you don't want to have happen. Because when those people go, you're going to have a class war like you've never seen before anywhere. I mean, you'd have to go back to the French Revolution to duplicate this. And not a word about it. What about the senior citizens? Where's their movement? You have more senior citizens than you have youth. They have more education, they've been through more, and they have more disposable income. Where's their movement? Where's the professional movement? Where are all the engineers and the lawyers and the architects and the social workers? Where are they at? Why haven't they been there? Why haven't they created their own movement? Where are the middle class? You haven't seen them yet. You've seen only a fraction. You haven't seen the poor yet. And because you haven't gone to where the poor are. So if you want to know who's got something that they're concerned about and what you can do to help them, then look carefully and you'll see that the one group that is speaking out, and I'm happy they're speaking out, I encourage them and I'm there to support them, or I wouldn't have gone down there and done all the stuff I have. But they've got to understand that the issues that they could address, they also are there now. They're not having to rewrite history. They're not the beginning of time. They're not the beginning of a revolution. Take a look at all the people who came before them. Are they even aware that they can sue the government and look to see what the government has on them based upon the Freedom of Information Act Ralph Nader got? That didn't happen overnight. They can drink water that's fairly clean and breathe air that's fairly safe because it was worked on for decades. Not to respect what has come before you is to disrespect the relevance of it. So sitting around having the meetings, which I filmed yesterday, and spoke with the people about, you know, this is our assembly, and this going to be all coming and going, enormous amount of transience, but do something constructive. If you had a boycott today, boycott all colleges and universities. Shut down every college and university in the United States. Close down, no more payments. Watch how quickly the universities suddenly readjust their schedule, suddenly readjust their curriculum, suddenly readjust their cost, their tuition, and then say never again another penny of the federal government on any loan. No, what's the government going to do? What's it going to do? The government can't go after 30 million people. They can't lock them all up in jail. And then it shows the bankruptcy. But you can't do it both ways. You can't sit there and protest Goldman Sachs and then have stock in Goldman Sachs. You can't protest corporate America and then be eating a McDonald's. You can't be sitting there because it just today, with what we know, there's too much going on that says we can stop it. You take the money out of corporate America's bank accounts and you have started death by 1,000 cuts. But if all you do is show up in ever larger numbers, you take over parks, and if you don't come out of that in the rather near future with some decisive action, the rest of the world is watching. And the empowered minority that are out there will not empower the majority to act. But if you get behind an issue that impacts them, something specific, then you can empower a whole country to get behind you. And you can challenge the body politic in a defiance that they're not capable of handling. Right now, corporate America is figuring these people will come when the winter comes, when it really gets bad, when the new cycle is passed in another 4 to 6 weeks, then it'll all start to dissipate. Do you remember anything about Fukushima now? Mm. Nothing? Anything?
Well, we do, because we...
We do, and I'm going to report on it tonight. Yeah. We're now finding radiation all over Japan, all over. Hot spots,
but not a thing
in the American media. Anything about Haiti? Anything. Do they all have work? Are they all eating? Cholera gone? No. It's gotten worse, not better. Watch what happens when the news cycle shifts to something else, and then you'll see what I'm talking about. So the left, unfortunately, has become excessively exuberant without criticism, and the right has been dismissive without proper thought or analysis. Shame on both sides. I'm Gary Nall. I hope that answers your question. And that brings up the end of another program. I thank you all for listening. For those of you listening on BAI, 2 more hours to go.
Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tattenfeld.